Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
The red thread is this idiom from Nordic languages, generally in general Northern Europe, to talk about, you know, the theme, the big idea of something. And its origin story, which I think we talked about last time, was very similar to the process that I was leading people through to do this decoding. And so I look back at it, you know, to me that, you know, when you look back, the past is a straight line. It all makes perfect sense to me, though there was no way at all that I could have predicted that this is where I would have ended up or what I would have ended up doing or even creating. But it makes perfect sense as I look back on it, because I created the thing that I wish I had 35 years ago.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Tamsin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am delighted to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I always say, anytime we have somebody back a second time, to me, that just says a whole hell of a lot about what an amazing guest they were the first time. You have a new book out, Finding Your Red Thread, which we will get into. But as you know from our previous conversations, that's definitely not where we're going to start. So I thought we would start by me asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced or shaped who you've become and what you've ended up doing with your life?
All right. So I'd say from my mother, who is an anthropologist, to observe what people do and to be curious about why they do it. I would say that's definitely from my mother. From my father, who's a systems thinker. So he's a submariner. He spent 21 years in the Navy. He's very focused on kind of two things, I think, that I've picked up from him. One is, you know, have a way to do it and be clear about it. And the second would be, my father is definitely like the lone extrovert in our family. And so I think that from him, I have learned to appreciate the, kind of the joy and the unexpected serendipity that can come from being kind of just talking to people and being curious about them. So my mother's very much kind of a quiet observer, and my father is an engaged, you know, interviewer of people, I think is probably a good way to think about it. And I think that there is value in both. And so I can see the lines of both of those influences in everything that I do.
Mm. So did your parents encourage any particular career paths while you were growing up? Because, I mean, as I've said before 1,000 times, the Indian kid sort of motivational speech is you can become any kind of doctor, lawyer, or engineer you want to be.
No, actually. And I think that's in a lot of ways because of their own parents, first of all. And then secondly, because in a lot of ways, and a little bit as a result, my parents ended up doing very non-traditional things as well. So my mother grew up really quite financially challenged, I think is absolutely fair to say. She was a shopkeeper's daughter in rural Washington State. Her family ran kind of the corner store where the gas station was, and you know, the food and meat and things like, you know, things like that. And she tells stories about how, you know, their food was the food that was past date from the store. My grandmother was apparently quite the dynamo. Both my grandmother and my grandfather on my mother's side, actually all of my grandparents, believe very, very strongly in the power of education. And so she was going to make sure that her kids went to college and went to a good one. And on that, she absolutely succeeded because both my uncle and my mother went to Stanford. In the case of my uncle, this was in the 50s, mid 50s. In the case of my mother, was the early 60s. And so that's kind of a big deal. And I think that, you know, I've never really talked with her about this, but I think other than go to college and go to as good of a school as you can get into, I don't think that was dictated what she ended up studying was very, you know, was very strongly dictated by anybody else. So, she went on to pursue, like I said, a doctorate in anthropology. She was very curious about social anthropology. And I think some of that was influenced by growing up so close to several indigenous nations, in the Skagit Valley, like the Snohomish Indians and all of that. My father, so his parents were both teachers. So my grandmother was a school teacher, and my grandfather had a doctorate in music education. And so he was a teacher of music teachers. While they weren't, as poor as my mother's family, that was, you know, these are teacher salaries. They didn't do much. So my father went to Stanford on the ROTC program. Fun fact, Stanford no longer has an ROTC program because in the 60s, the students burned it down. I think he was just fascinated to see the world, and the Navy was a way to do that and get a great education at the same time. And so I don't think either of them were constrained by that. And they certainly didn't constrain my sister or I in the same way, because we may have talked about this last time, but my sister went to Stanford also. My dad did too. I was the one that was like, I'm not even going to apply. My sister went to Stanford for a theater degree. So she got a theater degree from Stanford. I refused to even apply to Stanford, just, you know, out of 17-year-old piss and vinegar, I think. And I went to Boston University. And my parents, again, were very open. I think I was more I was more interested in making sure I was employable than anybody else in my family was. Even though I love the arts, I decided to get a business degree, both undergrad and grad, so that I wouldn't ever have to worry about being employable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So two things. You know, I wonder, did you ever feel the sort of pressure? I mean, two Stanford educated parents, a sibling who, you know, went to Stanford, when I look at my sister, she was the chief anesthesiology resident at Yale. I mean, she was at Berkeley after I was, but there was sort of this expectation that this is just what you do. You go to the best damn school that you can get into. And I always wonder when you have, you know, parents who are so accomplished academically, do you ever feel this sort of need to live up to that expectation?
I mean, I think I did, but again, my response was to reject it entirely. Because I think the closest I got to aspirational or like, you know, Ivy or Ivy Plus is I did apply to Harvard. And I think I flat out didn't get into Harvard. I don't think I was waitlisted. I think I was waitlisted at Amherst, maybe. But really what I wanted to do when I applied to college was I applied to the most, it's very funny that I ended up BU because it's not this, but what I really wanted to do was go to a very non-traditional college. So I applied to Bennington and I got an early action to Hampshire and I applied to Evergreen State. And I was really interested because I was really interested in crafting my own academic journey of kind of inventing. But, you know, I was very intrigued by those last three, what they did with independent study and how you essentially created your own path. And I was very interested in that because I had just spent 6 years at a pretty intense, I mean, no, it wasn't pretty intense. It was extremely intense prep school in Norfolk, Virginia. And I was over it. Not over school. I was really over pressure and deadlines because it actually had quite a negative effect on my whole psyche. And I absolutely believe that it was part and parcel of why I suffered with a panic disorder for so long afterwards. So I really just wanted to go to a place where I felt that I could make it mine. And that was really my response to everybody else going to Stanford was that's your thing. I'm going to do my thing. And I'm just going to carve my own path. Like I don't want to rely on anybody else. And I'm just going to do what I can do. And I'm going to do it my own way. So, but they didn't pressure. They really didn't. There was like, you can go wherever you want. I mean, that was kind of the deal that my parents had that they would send us anywhere. They'd pay for us to go anywhere. Undergrad, grad school was all on me. But undergrad, that was on them. And even though they were paying for it, they didn't put pressure on any direction. I think they really did just want us to pursue, do what we would stick with. I think they would do what we would stick with. I think they just wanted to make sure that we were set up well in life from that perspective. But that wasn't tied to any particular profession.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
You mentioned this idea of carving your own path, and I think that that's so much easier said than done. And I wonder, why do you think people fear doing that so much and, conform to either societal expectations, parental expectations, or, whatever their peers are doing? Because, I think even going to Berkeley, I remember thinking, oh, this is sort of this liberal hotbed of, innovative ideas, really original thinking. And I was like, wait, this place is a breeding ground for conformity. It's all just a bunch of soon-to-be bankers, lawyers, and doctors. And, the evidence kind of plays out because that's what most of my classmates did. Right.
It's definitely easier to conform. And I don't know. There is truly something in me that rejects it. I understand it and I know how to play along. And that's definitely, I think, to add another tick in my mother's column, that comes from the observation of people. I understand how I understand what I'm supposed to do. But there are times when where it just doesn't feel right. And, by ignoring that feeling, that absolutely got me where I got to with panic disorder for a long time. And then once I started getting treatment for that, which started when I was 16, by the way, 16, 17, I started to become intolerant of that feeling of dissonance between what I was supposed to do and what every fiber of my being said I needed to do. But I will tell you, it's a lot harder because you have to deal with the fact that there is not a path. There's no map, as Seth Godin would say. You don't get to just follow in what somebody else does. You have to take ownership of that. Certainly something I discovered when I started my own business 5 years ago. One of the things that I often said about it to other people at the time was that I traded the illusion of stability for the reality of control.
I love that.
And it was because it's true, but it also means that it is all on you. And I wish I knew. I wish I could tell someone here, here's the secret to doing your own thing. other than that I became finely attuned, and I think that was this kind of dark gift of panic disorder, finely attuned to dissonance, to any gap, because I would feel it physically, a gap between, an expectation and reality. And so I spent a lot of my time just trying to, in the early years, try to ignore that gap. But then there were certain places that were just so foundational to me in some way, like where to go to college, what to study, that I just couldn't. And so, I could kind of toss off that, I'm going to go to BU, mostly because I loved the city and that's why I went. And BU was a fairly safe school. One could argue it wasn't even the best school that I got into. But, it ended up being the right place for me because, again, this is kind of anathema to conformity. I mean, the same thing. I was in the undergraduate business school and I'm like, you people, I don't understand you people. And mostly because I spent all my time in high school with arts people. So here I am following and in with the business school people. And I'm like, I don't get you. And so I spent most of my time in high school. In college. My college friends are all the people I worked with at the nightclubs on Lansdowne Street in Boston. That's where all my friends are from. Anyone who I do have from my college years who's still a friend was somebody I met working in the clubs, not somebody who was in one of my classes. Full stop. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, people like this idea of sort of a formula or prescription for, how to run a business or how to do your own thing. And I've been, you know, sort of writing and thinking about this idea of sort of this distinction between prescriptions and principles. And, you know, I realized there's one fundamental flaw in this whole idea of prescriptive advice. There's a variable that throws off all of it, and that's you.
Yes.
And people don't take yes. that into account at all. They tend to overlook context. And I guess what I wonder is how you get people to stop looking for prescriptive advice, which is kind of hilarious because your book is prescriptive in a lot of ways.
It is in a way. And yeah, that is actually a thing that I wrestle with about it, except for the fact that I feel very comfortable with the amount of research that I've done to say, okay, this is about as prescriptive as I can get for you. And then the rest of it, you're going to have to fill in yourself. Because I think of it more as a framework than a formula. And I think that to me is what allows for the individual, that allows for that variability. And I think, you know, the way that I frame what you just talked about is that a lot of people are looking for what to think when actually what they need to learn is how they think. And because once you understand how you think or find ways to think about things, the what to do becomes a lot clearer. You know, there's something I wrote in my newsletter a few weeks ago as an example of this, which is, you know, a lot of times when we're talking to other people about ourselves or, you know, we're just like, well, here's what I think. And a lot of times we don't get into like, well, how did you come to that conclusion? But it's in the how did you come to that conclusion that we actually understand whether or not we're seeing eye to eye on something or not. And the example that I drew a couple of weeks ago in my newsletter was like Ultron from the Avengers Age of Ultron, where, of course, you know, you had two completely different approaches to the same answer of protect planet Earth. You know, Ultron is like, well, it's the people that are the problem. And then you've got, so let's eliminate the people and that's how we're going to protect planet Earth. And then, you know, another group who, you know, the Avengers, obviously, who are thinking, well, we need to protect planet Earth and maintain the people. And so I think, to me, there's really something intriguing. I'm just so fascinated about how people think, because if I can understand how people think, and then, you know, with what I tried to do with the book, help people understand how they themselves think about things, it becomes so much easier to make that more transparent. And so this is a strange word to apply to interpersonal interactions. It makes them a lot more efficient because you're not discovering kind of too late that, you know, oh, we may have agreed on the ends, but we sure as heck didn't agree on the means to those ends. And ultimately I think I'm coming to a place where I believe that the things that we need to share with people lie more in the means than in the end. I mean, it's certainly something that I say to my business clients that, you know, you're never going to be able to sell to someone who doesn't fundamentally value the same things you do or operate from the same baseline assumptions about how the world works as you do. Yeah. So you better be clear on what they are, and it's going to be a lot easier for you and for them if you are articulate those things out loud.
Yeah, it's funny because it reminds me of something Victor Cheng says in his book, Extreme Revenue Growth. One of the things he talks about, he basically identifies sort of what he calls the five components of a revenue growth engine. And one of them is, you know, a problem that somebody has. But the other part of that that is missed often is that people care enough about that problem that they're willing to pay to solve it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people just go, well, here's a thing that hasn't been done yet. I'm like, yeah, the paying to solve it. Yeah, I that's one of the things that I've come to understand is that, you know, one of the, and I think there's three, one of the key beliefs that someone has to have before they will make a change in thinking or behavior is that they have to consider it worth it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is a financial calculation, and sometimes it's an effort calculation, and sometimes it's a esteem and other people as expectation calculation. Because that's certainly what came into play as I kind of rejected the Stanford path. I was like, yeah, but it's actually worth it to me to see if I can succeed without all the legacies. Like, what can I do on my own? That's been an important part, I think, of who I've grown myself to be.
Yeah. So before we get into the book, I want to ask you one last thing. I know, you know, from having read the book that you're a parent, and just given sort of this legacy of, you know, elite universities and education, I wonder how you think about education for your children, because, you know, from the time that you went to college, I went to college, from when your parents went to college, the world is really different today.
Yeah.
You know, and when I see things, you know, I watched this documentary on the college admission scandal, and watching these kids and thinking, God, like, this must be such a difficult time to be applying to college, because it's this sort of idea that this is basically going to determine everything about how your life turns out is kind of the pressure, yeah. the message they seem to be getting from the world around them. So I wonder, one, how you talk to your kids about this and how you think about educating your own children.
I do think about this a lot. And I think a lot about it in the context that I have my older son has just started, while it's not a private prep school, it's a pretty intense school here for middle school here in Boston, Boston Latin. It's a very well-known public school, the oldest one in the U.S., as that turns out. But I mean, it in a lot of ways looks and feels like the intense pressure cooker of what I went through in my middle and high school years. So like, I was inherently not so sure about this. But the thing that he and his father and I were very clear on was that I did my best, as did his father, to I didn't actually care if he chose to go there or not. It's an exam school, meaning he had to take an exam to get into it. And the way we framed that, and his dad and I were on the same page with this, was if you want to take the exam, do. And if you take the exam, that just opens up your options to where you want to go to school. But you can go wherever you want. So there's that piece of it. The second piece of it is that I'm kind of glad that I didn't go the whole legacy route, because, you know, even though it's an N of one, I have, you know, it's a form of success, I think, that I have. And I did it with not, you know, it's, again, not that BU sucks. It doesn't. It's a fine school. It's not Ivy Plus. It's not Stanford. But you know, I have been successful without the additional benefit of a network like Harvard or Stanford or, you know, any of those top tier schools would have provided. But at the same time, I think the trade-off, and to me it was positive, it was worth it, was that I wasn't surrounded by the need to conform. You know, I felt that a little bit more in grad school when I went to business school for grad school as well. And there I went to Southern Methodist, and the Cox School of Business. And what was interesting was there, I did briefly conform. It didn't last very long. I mean, it's hard not to conform when like I go into business school thinking that I'm going to go work at a nonprofit. And then the job that I got, you know, as a part-time research assistant in the consulting company, like paid me twice what I would get as a full-time position in a nonprofit. And so you're like, oh, I'll conform. That lasted 6 months after graduation from, you know, because I was just like, I can't, maybe it was just Dallas. I don't know. But I was like, I can't do this. And then took a 50% pay cut and went and worked at a museum. So I have the belief in my children that they will be successful no matter what they choose to do, and that the path to success lies in spending as little time as possible off of what makes you happy and what makes you useful to other people. Because I think it's in the flailing around that we lose time and we lose energy and we lose inspiration. But the more you can stick with the thing, find the thing and stick with it that gives you joy, great. And so we've even said to the boys that, you know, we want them to go to school because we think that there is value in what school will teach you about how to think, how to learn those kinds of things and the variety of those kinds of answers you can find there. But we've also been very clear that if they choose to go to, let's say here in Boston, we've got a place called the North Bennett Street School that teaches fine for preservation carpentry and violin making and book binding, like old school artisanal crafts. I'm like, if that's where you want to go, or you want to go to Boston Architectural College or something, you know, something like that, like a, essentially a trade school, fine. If that's what you want, do the thing that you love and do the thing that you will stick with and do the thing that will keep you motivated and working, because you're going to have to motivate and work for a really long time. So you need to be, that needs to be something that you love. And so we try to just, we try to keep that door open for them in any way possible and as free of expectation as possible. Because as I said, I believe in them and I believe in their success, because that is what they've already, those are the small humans they've already proven themselves to be.
Wow. Well, do this for me. Connect the dots for how all of these different experiences of your life lead to the work that you're doing today and how it leads to this book.
You know, it is all totally intertwined. I think that some of my, some of the understanding about how I see the world and trying to understand why how I see the world is different than other people, where that came from, where that was painful for oftentimes for a long time. That's a thread that's in here. Another thread that's in here is feeling unheard a lot, as you know, from you know, teens on up through college and work and all of that. You know, in the early days of work, I'm sure we've all had this experience where you get dismissed because of youth. That tended to happen a lot with me because I was young. I actually was younger than a lot of other folks wherever I was. I way back when skipped first grade. So I started college at 17. I didn't turn 21 until the spring of my senior year. I went straight into business school. So I was in business school at the age of 21, graduated 23. And so here I was, like, you know, wherever I was, particularly in the early parts of my career, I was always a little and usually much younger than everybody else around me. That, of course, did not limit my feeling that I had good ideas. But there was so often where either I knew I had a great idea and I couldn't make the case for it in a way that got it across. And so I felt like that, and therefore I was dismissed. Or I often was very frustrated with not having an articulate way to answer something. And so those were kind of these personal threads that I carried forward with me for a really long time. The fact that, you know, I hate a blank page. I don't like not knowing where to start. Like, I don't like being told what to do, obviously. But I don't like not knowing, like, just give me a framework that I can try on and then just see if it fits. And then I'll make it my own from there. So there's that piece. There was another piece which was rooted in this tension of being this arts kid in business school, for so many years. And the fact that these did represent really true two sides of me that coexisted in my head, sometimes well and sometimes not, which is that I have a deep love for kind of the passion based things, the arts and deep research and scholarship and just going deep on stuff. I love that. And also there's a very, very strong practical bent that sometimes works straight up against passion projects. And through observation, thanks mom, I realized I'm not the only person who feels and experiences that tension between what's passion driven and what's practicality driven. But because I spent so much of my time in both worlds, I did that always. It was always a way for me to get a different perspective on things. So when I was, yes, I was an arts kid in high school, but I was also the manager of the varsity boys baseball team. And so yes, I studied business when I was at BU, but I also got a liberal arts degree in American studies and art history at the same time. And yes, I went to business school for organizational behavior, but I also got a master's in arts administration. And every role that I took on tended to sit in this kind of intersection between two on the surface competing worlds. So even when I took my pay cut and went back to the museum, I was sitting at the intersection between the marketing and the fundraising departments at a museum, which are kind of like, I mean, if you're not familiar with how nonprofits can go against each other with marketing and fundraising, think of any for-profit business and the tension that naturally exists between marketing and sales. It's the same. And when I was doing just even traditional marketing, okay, I sat between the world of the institution. So this is where a lot of, and I was the marketer at a very, you know, deep, passionate places like, an art school at the Boston Conservatory and the medical school at Harvard. And again, here was this, and my job as the marketing person was to translate these deep passions into things that people could understand. And again, I saw this tension between, here are these amazing ideas and these amazing passions. And then the people who are not that could benefit so much and enjoy that stuff, but they just haven't found the path to each other. And then it really, so there, this was just, this is a constant theme in my life of how do you, of this kind of translation of sitting between two worlds and operating in between them. And I did it so long that I seem to have become in a lot of ways this kind of like human Rosetta Stone, where I could talk about passion in practical terms, but I could also kind of take the practical notion and translate it back to the artists and the scholars and the scientists about like, okay, I get that you're doing this, but okay, let's take in this kind of practical aspect of we need to raise money for it and we need to pay for it. So how do we do that? And it really started to come into super sharp focus 8 years ago when I had the opportunity to become the executive producer of TEDx Cambridge. And these academics, scientists, scholars, these deeply passionate people, now here was this very specific event where they needed to, in many ways, encapsulate an entire body of work in 3 to 18 minutes. For a lay audience, for people who didn't share their industry, who didn't necessarily share their passion, but they're the whole point of TED and the ideas worth spending is to ignite that interest in somebody else. And so I wanted to figure out what would be a decoder ring. Like, and that's really what turned into the red thread that the book is all about, because the red thread is this idiom from Nordic languages, generally in general Northern Europe, to talk about, you know, the theme, the big idea of something. And its origin story, which I think we talked about last time, was very similar to the process that I was leading people through to do this decoding. And so I look back at it, you know, to me that, you know, when you look back, the past is a straight line. It all makes perfect sense to me, though there was no way at all that I could have predicted that this is where I would have ended up or what I would have ended up doing or even creating. But it makes perfect sense as I look back on it, because I created the thing that I wish I had 35 years ago.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember, I mean, partner, I think you probably remember this, when I had to give a speech that was 15 minutes. I remember I hired you because I was like, okay, I don't know how to give a 15 minute speech. That's way harder than giving an hour long speech.
It is.
But let's get into the concepts in the book. You opened the book by saying the best way to make your idea irresistible, and you said this book could have been one sentence, the best way to make your idea irresistible is to build a story that people will tell themselves about it. The biggest obstacle to inspiring your audience to act is the gap between what you want to say about your idea and what people need to hear about it. To be inspired to act, the human brain needs to hear a specific structure, and it all comes down to story. And when I read that, I couldn't help but think of some of the things we learned from Meet's copywriting course, where everything was about shifting the focus from yourself to your audience. Mm. And what I wonder is why people get so stuck on the story they want to tell versus the story that people need to hear about it.
Because it's how they see the world. I don't even think that they get, it's just, it is the operating system, and a computer can't read its own code. We do not even realize that we are stuck in our story. We don't realize that everything that we say is coming from the point of view of somebody who has already reached this conclusion, already thinks that the idea is great. And we don't even realize that we've done it. It's the curse of knowledge made real. And that's it. That's the simplest explanation, is that we just don't even realize that we are telling it, you know, we are telling the story that we want to hear, because it's the story that makes sense to us, full stop. And so we think it must by definition make sense to other people. And yet that's a known psychological fallacy and loop. Like, you know, we believe that the people around us generally believe the same things we do. And it's actually not true. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like it's so important that we are clear about our own way of thinking, so that we can be clearer about others, because it doesn't mean that we're not capable of closing those gaps, but we sure as heck can't close them if we don't know where they are. So yeah, I think that's what it is that we're operating from a code that we can't see. And the part of what, you know, it's if there's a hidden agenda of the book, that's it. If there's kind of a free prize of the book, that's it. That it's actually a way to understand your own point of view, your own worldview in a really clear, I think, way that allows you to have now be able to kind of step back, open that control window into your own operating system and go, oh, I see what I'm doing here, and I see why I'm doing it. And once you understand that, you've got all sorts of opportunities available to you, because sometimes you're going to see things you don't like and then you want to change them. Sometimes you'll see why you get stuck in patterns and you can change them. And sometimes you can see where you had strength and power and consistency I wrote this book because I wanted it. It's a book that solves for my own neuroses. I 100% understand that. But when you understand that, you know, actually there is a pattern and a good one, you know, for how you've lived your life so far, I think there's power in that. And that was really part of what's important to me. It's not what I lead with in the book, but it is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it reminds me, one of my mentors said, he said, I don't think you understand your audience as well as you think, because he said, you've never been in an office for the last 10 years.
Yes.
And because I read a lot about productivity, and it finally occurred to me that he was absolutely right, that, you know, the advice that, you know, is applicable for a single guy is not the same or nearly as effective for a mother with an infant. I learned this from one of our former guests who shows up to our mastermind calls with a baby in tow. I'm like, okay, never mind. An hour a day is probably not that realistic for her.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think probably again comes back to my mother. And I would say, so I think we talked about this too, that one of the things that I studied when I was in college was American Studies. And I don't know if American Studies found me or I found it, because it is very anthropological in its way of looking at all the forces coming at play and for American Studies on a particular time period or a particular movement or moment. I don't know if I already did that, and therefore it was just a validation and a way to make that kind of more of an official path for me, or whether it just fit really well. And so when I tried it on as a framework, it continued to work very well. But I think you understand your own perspective and your own self and your own ideas so much better when, to the extent possible, you can look at them through others' eyes, that I've always just found value in that. And I mean, full disclosure, that it came from kind of a dark place, because, you know, I think while my parents didn't, you know, push me to go to Stanford and say I needed to be a doctor, a lawyer, or engineer, I was expected to be right. I was expected to be correct. And there was a high price paid in my family for not being right. I mean, it was an emotional one, but there was a big focus on being correct and being right. And my family is also a family of, and I forget whose perspective this was originally, where they talk about there's like two cultures at play. You know, one of those classic oversimplifying of people into like two groups, but that there's askers and there's guessers, where askers ask for what they want and they tell you exactly what they need and they say, you know, here basically are my operating instructions, follow them and we'll be good. And then there's guessers who are sent or basically go, well, guess what I need, and don't consider it proper to say it out loud, and that you should just know. Well, from a wiring standpoint, you know, at least how it felt in my family was that I was an asker and everybody else was a guesser. And I actually think that my sister's probably more of an asker than I give her credit for, but it meant that, you know, that plus my anthropological mother meant that I spent a lot of time anticipating my parents first and foremost, my sisters, and then eventually, you know, colleagues, coworkers, fellow students, you know, friends, lovers, everybody. Like I spent a lot of time anticipating other people's reactions and trying to figure out in advance, trying to account for the guessers, you know, from an asker's point of view. I think the more that we can, I mean, I don't, one of the things I say to my clients is I overthink so you don't have to. That's part of what I really wanted to get through into the book too, was just like, listen, if you can answer these questions about your idea, it's going to be just about as rock solid as you can make it. As you could, because I've incorporated that like lifetime of lessons on where people are going to pick something apart and where something would fall apart, where an argument, where an explanation would fall apart. And it's all baked in. I mean, I elected not to write the book from that perspective. I really wanted to write the how-to, really practical book. But you know, there's probably three books worth of support for why every piece is exactly the way that it is.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the pieces. When you say goal, problem, truth, change, action, these five elements are the answers to the questions your brain, everyone asks about ideas. So can you walk us through this framework and how we apply it to our ideas?
Yeah. So the story of those elements is that they are the fundamental building blocks of any story. And a point of academic inquiry for me still is whether these building blocks are what the brain required, and that's why stories have them, or that stories have been so built into our society that that's what we've learned to look for over time. But they are what they are because of the role that they play in how we make sense of information. And the first one, the goal, is why somebody would act at all. Because the goal, as I define it, is it's something somebody wants and doesn't yet have. And when we're talking about once upon a time stories, that's when we, the reader, the audience, the viewer, the listener, that's when we really start to engage. It may not be where the kind of quote unquote action of the story starts, but it's where our emotional engagement starts. So that's the goal. And that's why somebody would act in the first place, to achieve a thing. That's what they want. They don't have it yet. So they need to act in order to get it. The next thing that comes into play, once upon a time stories and in the story of an idea, is a problem that somebody doesn't know about when they get started. It's the reason why they don't have that thing yet, right? So if you want a thing and you don't have it, well, there's a reason you don't have it yet. Why don't you have it yet? And so the problem is rooted there. When we're talking about the problem, quote unquote, as it shows up in the red thread, is that it's a problem of perspective, meaning it's a tension in perspective. It's not a problem per se. It fills the role of the problem, meaning that there's a way that people are looking at the situation right now that's keeping them from seeing another way to be. And so that's what we have to identify. The third major building block is, you know, that contrast between the way they've been looking and the way they could look, inevitably brings up a conflict, or should, because every great story has, you know, what's called a moment of truth, a point of no return, a climax. And my favorite word for it, like total Scrabble word, anagnorisis, which is the moment the main character recognizes the true nature of their circumstances. And that's where the conflict of any story comes to a head. And so in the story of an idea, back to our conversations earlier, Srini, about these baseline assumptions, there is something about how each of us individually sees the world that when we're in the pursuit of something and we realize that we're looking at the situation differently than everybody else, there is a reason why that is such a problem to us. And that is what I call the truth, because it creates that moment of truth. And when those things are all in play, something we want, something we believe, and two contrasting perspectives, something's got to give. And you know, where in a once upon a time story, that moment of truth forces a choice, right? That means something's going to change. Either you're going to give up what you want, or you're going to stop doing something or start doing something. That's what in the red thread is the fourth piece. It's the change that's the result of that moment of truth. So goal, problem, truth, change. And then, you know, most stories don't stop with a decision. Action is the proof of understanding, as I like to say. So that's the fifth piece of the red thread, or what are the specific actions that need to be put in play in order to make that change concrete. And all of those actually lead you back to the goal. So while there are five components, one of them is repeated, because a story, any story, brain story, once upon a time story, ends back at the beginning when we see whether or not we got what we were looking for in the first place. And if we didn't, did we get something that we needed even more instead? So goal, problem, truth, change, action. As I say in the book, they are the things that make us make something make sense. They're, why would someone do it? Why don't they have it yet? Why is that such a problem for them? What can they do instead, given what they know? How do they do that? And then, all right, what's the final result?
Wow. So I have a couple of questions about this. One, I wonder is what role does research and data play in all of this? So, you know, I can go back to an example, you know, when we were talking earlier about the fact that just because somebody has a problem, it doesn't mean they care enough that they're willing to pay to solve it. Now, I'll give you a concrete example. So we recently launched a course called Attention Mastery because the overwhelming majority of our audience said, you know, which is not surprising given that it's probably everybody's biggest problem these days, that, you know, their challenge was managing their time and their attention because they're constantly distracted. So we created a course and it sold relatively well. But, you know, when we were looking at it, I said, wow, people might have this problem. They don't necessarily care enough that they're willing to pay to solve it.
Yeah. That's true. So where does data come in as far as understanding that you've got each of these pieces correct?
Exactly. So, you know, people go through, you know, surveys trying to understand what their audience needs or whatever it is. It's pretty standard, you know, sort of market research tactic. But, you know, how do you adapt the data into a red thread?
So there's a couple of different ways. And this is when I get to smile bemusedly because I'm married to a market researcher. I'm married to, you know, researcher and statistician. And so, you know, I've actually talked about this quite a bit because I get this question from clients a lot. They're like, well, how much do I already need to know about this? And how much research do I need to do? And, you know, official, like, professional market researcher, blessed answer, and which you know, is that you need to do as much research as you need to do to feel comfortable. And as he would say, what's the price for not doing the research ahead of time? So that's his official answer. So in a lot of cases, I think it's useful, particularly for, you know, if this is a high stakes kind of messaging that you're putting together, that you're building a lot on it, it's probably worth doing some level of, I would say, qualitative research to start. And qualitative research is important to start because it is what gives you an understanding of trends, of motivations, of questions to answer. And as Tom, my husband, would tell you, you know, qualitative should always precede quantitative because quantitative research is what you come in afterwards to drill down on something that was revealed from qualitative information. Now, you can do this officially, right? You can go and hire somebody like Tom or Edison, the company he works for, to do that kind of research. My experience, honestly, is that in the vast majority of cases, doing more research is just a means of procrastination on this because generally, particularly since we're talking about your individual or your company's point of view, you already know enough to answer most of these questions, at least to draft a red thread to start. And then once you've got the elements, it's worth going out, back out and testing that again, whether that's officially, and professionally or anecdotally, because the red thread is designed to get you to something that you can socialize. And that's what I say about it. I mean, and an idea exists in between. There was a really fascinating conversation with Steve Jobs about this kind of the late 80s, early 90s, where he's talking about, how you need when you're coming up with ideas, you have to be willing to let it go to see what other people do with it. And the red thread is a way that gets you there. But because it starts with who you're for and what problem that you want to solve with them, there is this kind of intersection between what you know for sure is true about the people that you're talking to and the people that you want to have coming to you. And I think that that's an important intersection because and this is a lesson I learned in when I was doing nonprofits. So I think it's particularly dangerous for nonprofits because there's money behind these conversations. And what I mean by that is, you know, any nonprofit organization has a mission. It's one of those things that over time, for-profit companies have taken on as like a thing that they've borrowed from the nonprofits, this kind of mission statement thing. But for nonprofits, it's really important because that's exactly the reason why they exist. And nonprofits need money. And that money often comes from people with their own agendas and their own mission statements, you could say. And so what can happen in a nonprofit is that in the pursuit of money that they need to stay open, they can pull themselves pretty far off mission because they need to get the money. And over time, like, you know, one time here or there isn't going to be a problem. But if you consistently do that, then all of a sudden you've pulled the money away from your core mission and you're ending up doing this kind of mishmash of things instead. And I think that same lesson is true for anybody and any organization, is that you want to make sure what you're looking for is a balance between the people that you serve and what you want to serve them. And that if you go too far to what the market wants, quote unquote, you'll end up constantly chasing that and never be able to put down roots where you are and not build the equity and the experience in that place. And at the same time, you don't want to be blind to it, because then, to your point that we were talking about earlier, then you end up solving a problem that nobody has. And so it really is about finding that intersection. And, you know, it was really interesting in the early parts of the pandemic. You know, I saw a lot of people do what I was calling moving to COVID town, meaning rather than stay where they were and find a way to kind of draw new maps from where people were kind of concerned about what does this mean for my job, or I've got this new focus on whatever, and showing them how whatever they offered, like whatever you offer, was still relevant to those people. You just need to draw a different path to it. I saw a lot of people kind of move to COVID town, like, well, I'm going to completely change what I do and change everything about my messaging because that's where the market is. Except you've just moved to a new town. Like, you don't know where anything is. People don't know you there. It's a lot easier to kind of establish and make really strong connections with what you've already been doing and just draw better maps. And so I think it's a perpetual challenge, but it really does come down to that balance between what do you already know, what do you want to be true, and what is actually true. And I think that's it's a fairly personal decision of how much research you do beforehand, and what the nature of the research is afterwards.
Yeah. So there's one line in particular, and this is probably my favorite line from the entire book. And I wanted to ask you about this. You say you can't create change, only the conditions for it. Sure, you can inspire someone to act. Depending on the situation, you could even force them. Action is occasional and often externally driven, but change is something quite different. As I like to remind people, when two truths fight, only one lives. Our brains cannot really let conflicts like that stand. We will change in order to relieve that mental discomfort.
Yep.
And, you know, I couldn't help but think about sort of something as simple as sort of everything we know about productivity and attention management, for example.
Yep.
We have all the information we need. You know, we've had Cal Newport here 3 or 4 times as a podcast guest. We have distraction blockers galore. So, you know, like you said, we have the conditions to actually change that behavior, but we don't, you know, and yet people don't.
Yep. It's because they want something else more. Full stop. I mean, that I am so convinced of this. Like, that was my sole foray onto a TEDx stage was about this, where I say the problem isn't that you don't love your goals enough; it's that you don't hate your problems more. And and it's a lesson I learned at Weight Watchers. To go back to my bio, it's a very hard truth to accept. But fundamentally, and it's very dramatic, you know, in weight loss or health management. And I would imagine the same thing is true with attention and time management. That the reason you're not doing something is because in a moment, there is something you want to do more. And if you don't bring that clarity to yourself, if you're not honest with yourself about that thing, is that you may want both things, but when push comes to shove, one of them's winning out. And are you comfortable with that? That's what it's going to come down to. Because if you're not doing what you need to do to manage your time, if you're not doing what you need to do to manage your health the way that you want to, it's because there is something else that in that moment you actually want more. What is that thing? And it could be comfort. It could be reassurance. It could be, I don't know, like, it can be so many different things. But, you know, that when two truths fight, only one lives piece, again, is something that I called forth from my own experience, because it's how it's that kind of clarity about my own motivations, about surfacing those baseline assumptions and really forcing them and to choose where that's in that moment where you can go, but I don't want to be someone who chooses that. Okay. Well, now that you know that that's what you're doing, now it's much more of a conscious choice. Because most of the time we just don't let ourselves confront those things. And I forget who says it, but there's, you know, somebody who says it's a mark of intellect, you know, of intellect that you can hold two truths in your head simultaneously. Absolutely. And still, but there will always come a moment where you're going to have to choose one of them and one of them will win out. And I just, you know, if there's one thing that I've truly learned in this life is that your ability to surface that tension in your mind and be honest with yourself about what you're choosing is where the power of all change actually lies.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really beautiful and fitting end to our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
It's their point of view. I think there are, and this is a thing that's gotten sharper and sharper over, you know, the last few years for me, is that two people can be solving the same problem. They can have a very similar answer. But nobody has lived the life that you have. And these individual components, you know, they are what I talk about in the book, but each of them reflects a point of separation, a fork in the road between different people on what could look at like very similar paths. But it really comes down to the fact that literally no one has your exact same point of view. And your ability to surface that point of view, to live it, to embody it, to articulate it, to be it, to be true to it, to honor it, to further it. It's the people who do that that are the ones that you say, at least that I say, are truly unmistakable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
Everything else is at tamsinwebster.com. I'm literally the only Tamsin Webster in the universe, so it's easy to find me. Yes, thanks, Mom and Dad, for a weird first name. but everything's there. And if they want to go straight to more information about the book, they can go to redthreadbook.com. That will land them on their page, my home page. Well, land them on my website anyway, but there they can go to, they can find it. They can get some extra goodies, for ordering it if they want. And, I am happy that people are responding well to it. So it is delightful. And I hope your listeners find it useful.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.